Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton, the creator and host, and for anyone there who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series because I feel passionate about invigorating the public dialogue that's taking place at the growing edge of consciousness and culture by asking one critical question from many perspectives. And that question is, how can higher human consciousness and practice enable human beings to rise to meet the unique challenges of this time of unsustainable imbalance and global crisis? This is part of a series of conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers, which you can access by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. Today, my guest is Jay Michelson, so we'll be continuing that discussion in a conversation we've titled Evolving Dharma and Evolving Practitioners. So I'll introduce Jay, and we'll spend about an hour in dialogue, and then after some announcements, we'll spend the last half hour or so taking your questions, either typed or live. So I expect that we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Jay Michelson is the author of 5 books and 200 articles on religion, sexuality, ethics, and contemplative practice. His new book, which will be released very shortly, October 15th, 2013, is Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment. His earlier books include Everything is God, The Radical Path of Non-Dual Judaism, God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, and a book of poetry, Another Word for Sky. Jay holds a JD from Yale, a PhD in Jewish thought at the Hebrew University, a BA from Columbia, and an MFA from Sarah Lawrence. He's held teaching positions at Boston University Law School, Harvard Divinity School, City College of New York, Yale University, and he's currently an advisor to the Varieties of Meditative Experience Project at Brown University. Jay embodies many qualities that make him an interesting kindred spirit for me. He's committed to political activism at the same time he's inspired and focused on serious meditative practice. He's got a skeptical, rational perspective and the openness and sincerity that comes with actual long-term dedicated meditative practice. He discloses his own experience and questions, and even questions himself, even while being a serious scholar grounded in philosophical principles in the history of religious and spiritual thought. He embraces life with lust and the transcendence of life with bliss. He holds the tensions and paradoxes of his many identities, including being a Jew, a Buddhist, a rational agnostic humanist, a gay man, a member of the millennial generation, and yet also something beyond all these identities. He totally gets it about how Dharma is evolving, and he's excited and inspired to participate in moving that forward. And what I especially appreciate about Jay is his curiosity and his willingness to rethink and reexamine his past and even current beliefs and conclusions. So, welcome, Jay. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Terry. I love that introduction. Thank you.
Well, great. You know, I thought a good place to begin might be where I began with you. I first encountered you through reading an essay on panentheism. It was the kind of thought embodied in your book, Everything is God. And I really appreciated the clear explication of this ground, this view, what panentheism is, what its implications are. Would you be willing to just briefly elaborate that as a grounding for our conversation today?
Sure. I think the way I understand panentheism is a sort of theistic perspective on non-duality. And it's distinct from pantheism, which is simply that everything in the manifest world is the divine. But it's distinct in a very funny way, because if you think of the divine as immanent and transcendent, or everything and nothing, the only difference between pantheism and panentheism is nothing. And I think for a lot of folks still working, and I include myself in this group, still working within a Western religious framework or a mystical or a contemplative framework, coming to some more sophisticated notion of God than, you know, the patriarch in the sky or the divine judge who punishes you if you're wicked and things like that, I think is really essential because that framework is so central to the worldviews of the Abrahamic traditions. And within those traditions themselves, you don't have to go beyond them. Within those traditions themselves, there are panentheistic currents that everything is God, that everything is in God, that God fills every atom of creation. So these are ideas which are expressed in a Western theistic view, but which will be familiar, I'm sure, to many listeners as a pretty clear non-dualistic cosmology.
You know, what I remember especially appreciating about whatever it was of yours that I read some years back was you kind of pointed to the elusive obvious being suggested and pointed to by so many different perspectives and practices because it subsumes and transcends and includes and is expressed in every fiber of existence, so that therefore every partial perspective has a kind of truth and validity, and that you were more or less saying once you're freed up from believing exclusively in any of these perspectives, you can appreciate them all and participate in them, and suddenly all kinds of apparently theistic or, you know, partial perspectives are kind of lit by the partial, by your kind of ecstatic apprehension of the partial truth of them from a panentheist, you might say an awakened panentheist perspective. And I was really very struck by that. I thought it was very clear and beautiful.
Thank you. I think it's really striking that two very prominent monistic traditions, so parts of Hinduism, Vedanta Hinduism, for example, and within the Jewish tradition, the Kabbalistic and Hasidic understandings that God is Ein Sof for everything without end, that those, you might think that those two traditions would then be very world-renouncing and monastic even, and let's get out of the world and just get to essence and leave aside manifestation. But in fact, the opposite turns out to be the case, right? That both of these traditions are noteworthy for their embrace of multiplicity. And it's multiplicity seen through, but nonetheless multiplicity experienced. And I think for me that's really important. Maybe it's just important for my own, you know, karma, for lack of a better word, just to having been born into this Western queer body that was told to repress delight for, you know, many decades. Any system of contemplative practice that doesn't transcend and include the body and delight and pleasure is, to me, heading off on the wrong track. So it's been really inspiring, I think, to wrestle with the tensions implicit in that dichotomy and the sort of the upward pointing triangle of the Jewish star toward the transcendent and the downward pointing triangle being the immanent, and really seeing those as interwoven and in fact the same.
Yeah. You know, I think for me the release into an appreciation of a radically non-dual and panentheist view leaves me with a very humble and kind of tender, tickled open, kind of glitter, you know, shimmering, alive appreciation for the amazing game of hide and seek that the ground of being is always playing through the apparent surfaces of manifestation, such that to continually awaken and to be present to the holiness or divinity of existence is an art that in each moment the way of relating to the particular pattern of perspective and experience that's arising calls for some particular quality that we might find in almost any spiritual tradition, whether that's courage or humility or awakening from identification with the stream of thoughts, or the particular move that a particular moment of experience demands of me is always unique, and therefore having any kind of formula at hand, like I'm always going to do this, creates a deadened relationship to that transcendent and imminent, paradoxical, elusive, obvious. But if I feel present to the, living, emerging, unknowable reality of that, and in a sense feel armed to bring any of the armamentarium of spiritual practices to bear, somehow I'm liberated into a, an uncluttered and very simple presence to the mystery that it all is. And I felt that you articulated the philosophical underpinnings of that attitude in a way that was valuable to me, and I've always appreciated you because of that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think that what you said about simplicity really resonates with me, and I know we'll get into this a little more in the next few minutes, but as my own practice has evolved and developed and moved toward the mundane, mundane meditation and mindfulness and Dharma practice, it's been really powerful, I think, that the endpoints end up being quite similar. What's going on and how can I relate to it, how can I be present with it, sweeping the floor, drinking the tea. The very basic materiality of everyday existence ends up being the endpoint of a panentheist worldview in which everything is God, and also a very almost rationalistic place where there might not be that, even without that consciousness, there can be that level of attentiveness and presence. And I think that for me has been really powerful. I remember wrestling a few years ago with kind of a koan of my own writing, which was, if there's no self, what is there? And that's if there's no small self, obviously. If we're not ultimately, and we can see this in meditation and in contemplative practice, we can see how the mechanism that we call the self, conventional self, is I think it was Sharon Salzberg who said that it's born in the blur. It's the blur of, hundreds, thousands, millions of movements of mind that we become very used to and label me. But if we look closely and where the mind is slow enough that we're able to do that and conditions are right, you can really see all of those conditions just popping, just arising, just like any other caused thing in the chain of being. And that subtractive move, if there's no self, what is there, leads to, remarkably, I think, this a very similar place to the additive move of everything is God or everything is consciousness.
Yeah. This is really a very rich area that I let's just dive right into it. When we spoke, as we agreed to do this interview, have said that you've dropped into a place where you sometimes orient with a kind of agnosticism about whether the nothing realized in what Tibetan Buddhists call luminous emptiness should be spelled with a small rather than a large N. And, that's kind of a way of expressing what emerges from what you just articulated, that the subtractive move, kind of radical questioning of all presumptions, even though it... there is a kind of emptiness at the end of whether you go additive, as you put it, or subtractive, whether you are recognizing the fullness and amazingness of God and everything is God and everything is lit up. But at a certain point, the light pervading everything is resolved into, the mountain is just a mountain. First there is a mountain, then there's no mountain, then there is a mountain, that it kind of goes back to a simplicity. And And you're kind of saying in that simplicity are these attitudes of all the ways in which it's holy and sacred and amazing and luminous and all the rest, perhaps best released in a more radical simplicity. And I'd love to talk with you about that, because I think that for many people, the reason that we practice is in a way to awaken from the hellish quality of our experience of a life that often is full of pain and seems to, you know, lack meaning, and it's the discovery of that fullness that is kind of the antidote to that that original impulse. So when you bring this kind of uncompromising, unsentimental agnosticism, and you deconstruct that holiness, do you lose that fulfillment of the original impulse to resacralize experience? And if not, what's the difference?
Yeah, I think that for me is, as you know, kind of the $64 question or $64,000 question. I'll start with just two pieces. One is that I'm definitely not in the business of deconstructing other people's theologies or worldviews that bring wisdom and compassion and joy into their lives. So I want to be clear not to evangelize for agnosticism. And second, that, you know, for me, I really don't know the answers to these questions. And it's the edge for me of where my own practice is now. Obviously, I came from a theistic tradition to a non-dualistic place and decided a few years ago to kind of do some more serious Theravadan Buddhist practice, which is very much not interested in those transcendent elements and is really interested in seeing through the unreliability and temporariness of and non-selfness, the emptiness of all phenomena, and just sort of very, very much a subtractive method. And as I described in the book, in Evolving Dharma, I became really interested in the possibility of, for lack of a better term, lasting change, you know, stage, not state, to use kind of Ken Wilber's language, that this would be, you know, that the tradition itself held forth that possibility, and that there was a roadmap, not that you can follow it slavishly and that it would be the same for everyone, but that there's a basic chart of where you might head. And so I did some serious practice for a while in that tradition and made quote-unquote progress according to the measuring sticks of that tradition, recognizing that all of these are just constructs, obviously. And it was one of the kind of, whether it was a side effect or a central effect of that focus, that particular practice focus, there was, as you describe, a kind of falling away of some of the I want to be sure not to use sort of judgmental language. I was going to say the need to label things as God or as holy, but that's not quite right. There was just a falling away of that movement of heart and mind. And you know, I remember reading one article by a Theravadan monk. Really, it's rare that, you know, there are too many texts where people really go after other traditions, but he really went after the Tibetan tradition that you're just mentioning. It's like, well, you have this experience of primordial awareness, but that's just a mental experience, and then it passes, and then you have another experience of it, and it seems similar, so you say it doesn't pass, but like everything else, it's just an experience of the mind that can open and close, and that can arise and pass. And, you know, I'm not sure I'm quite that zealous in my questioning of those experiences. And there's certainly, it's absolutely the case that, just like you said exactly with that Zen parable, that there's a mountain, then there's no mountain, and then there's a mountain. I think it's absolutely essential to go through the space of seeing clearly that there's no mountain, that whether we call it nothing with a lowercase n or an uppercase one seems secondary. The point is that there's no mountain. And that seems essential, but it is true that in my own path, I have found myself, it was not intentional, found myself in a less theistic place and yet still able to have the mind rest in itself and relinquish some of the fetters that are constantly tying us down. And the feeling of simply the mind resting in itself is very similar to what I used to call, I'll use another Wilbur phrase, you know, the simple feeling of being.
Now, the simple feeling of being, I guess the essence of it is that happy? Is that ecstatic? Is that blissful? Is that just empty? Is it sometimes have a quality of simple awareness that added, you know, that adding these descriptors about qualities to is sort of not the point? But yes, I guess if I look at it, there's no unhappiness, there's no disturbance in it, so you could talk about how happy it is, but really it just is. I mean, can you unpack that? Because I think that in a way the crux of this is the impulse to speak very, very simply and in an unadorned way as if it just is versus the impulse to speak very ecstatically and full of praise and responsiveness. And, you know, in the subtractive mode, you're not speaking ecstatically. And is that because you're less ecstatic? Is it really an emptier realization? Is it more denuded? Is it perhaps less prone to distortion because of that, but then perhaps also more Spartan and limited and austere in a way that actually does lose something that we ought not to fail to value?
Yeah, you know, I think there is actually a loss. I think it's a fortunate loss, but it is a loss. There is a, you know, I'm sure you've, like me, have hung around with Sufis over the years, perhaps been one yourself, and you know, there's a juiciness and a holy love that you feel in the presence of people doing that practice, you know, in a serious way, and they're really, really feeling it, that is beautiful. And it is true that I rarely experience that in the more cool, contemplative climates where I hang out now. But I do actually, you know, so in a way, it's as if I've kind of crossed over some place that I'm happy to have crossed over, because there is a happiness that comes just from the relinquishment. And, you know, you're saying, how do we describe this, the is? And I think in my experience, just again, speaking purely for my own, watching this experience come up, so there's some expanded awareness, there's the ineffable there. But the joy for me comes from the subtractive pieces, from what's not there. From the absence of clinging, or the, you know, less clinging, from the lower amount of neediness that's present in the mind. And it's almost as, you know, the joy when you're in a noisy place of going to a place that's silent or quiet. I think it's less that the silence is joyful, and more that the quieting now that one's able to experience, in contrast to the hustle and bustle, let's say, of a city street, it's that shift, that relinquishing, that relaxation, that dropping, that is actually quite joyful. That's quite similar to me to Satchitananda, to, you know, the joy that's present when there's a God consciousness that's really filling the mind. So that's been my experience.
Well, that sort of contradicts what you just said in a way, though. I mean, not to. I'm appreciating each thing you're saying, but I think that maybe driving right at the paradox is where the juice is here. On the one hand, if something is lost and yet you like where you're landing, what is it that was lost? You know, to me, there is this kind of brightening of the whole being, you know, brightening of the heart and really the whole embodied being in relation to the astonishing mystery and beauty and goodness and luminosity of being itself, and a kind of astonished gratitude simply to be, that is at the core of my apprehension of the mystery, or whatever I would call holy, sacred. And to me, the ideas about it and the kind of metaphysics and theological assertions and everything all feel like child's training wheel kind of stuff that I smile on benevolently, but don't need in that place. And I don't feel cluttered. I feel freed of the significance of beliefs or practices or noise. And yeah, there is a kind of noise in terms of sense impressions and even the impulses of mind and attention that are flowing through. But the beneficence of that quality of astonished, amazed, grateful noticing of the luminosity of things is the place of my freedom. And when I hear these more austere descriptions, they seem beautiful too, and I smile on them, but I'm not attracted. It feels a little less rich than my experience of fullness. So I'm wondering into that paradox from that side of the divide. And you know, what can you say, you know, as we compare notes as fellow contemporary mystics?
Yeah, I think you hit it just a couple of sentences ago, that it's almost a matter of taste or of style or of temperament. And I'm sure, you know, I certainly am a radical pluralist ecumenicist. I'm sure you are as well, that, you know, that for me is one of the big contributions of an integral approach, that these are, even if they're fingers pointing at different moons, they're still fingers pointing at a moon, and that there's more in common than not in common. And I think it's really, I think it's almost a matter of style, that and what fits with, again, whether we want to call it your soul or you're just your karma or whatever it is, that, you know, what's the vehicle that liberates and that leads to freedom, that leads to wisdom and compassion. And so it's not, I know you don't think this either, that, you know, one's better than the other. You know, I think for me, there are still times where I'll want a more juicy kind of ecstatic practice. But for me, what actually caused the letting go of that practice wasn't the heart of the Theravadin teaching, but something else I describe in Evolving Dharma, which is jhana practice, which is just concentrative absorption, in which you can really cultivate states. They're transient, but they're really lovely states that are really sublime. And just, you know, really, they're not liberating, but they are fully delighting and fascinating, and they help concentrate the mind, so you can do contemplative practice, you know, much, much easier. And it was encountering some of these really numinous experiences that were transparently entirely generated, self-generated, and that, you know, in certain Hindu traditions, the jhanas are actually considered to be divine realms. In the Buddhist tradition, they're considered to be mind states that are created by the meditator and the other conditions that are present. And, you know, some of the juiciest God-soaked experiences that I'd had in the past were reenacted, but even more intensely, in a way, in a frame that didn't contain that all that apparatus. And I think, you know, I totally agree with you. You know, when you're having the experience, the apparatus is laughable and irrelevant and not what it's about. And yet for me, I think somehow letting go of even that languaging has been liberating, to really see where my own attachments were. And I think, you know, possibly that's just due to my own background. You know, I do still work in the Jewish community, and there's a whole lot of attachment to, you know, to not just to God and to God experiences, but to myth and to land and to power and to all kinds of, you know, traps. And I was seeing it in myself. You know, it wasn't about seeing other people and judging them and they're, oh, I'm not going to do that because look what that leads to. It was seeing it in myself that there was some attachment to the truth of my peak experience, that this was not just a wonderful mind state, but that this was a higher form of knowing. Or to just up the ante even more, that this was consciousness coming, evolving and coming to know itself. I noticed in myself some attachment around those layers placed on top of an experience.
Mm. And perhaps a more, maybe what, I mean, I think that when we play at this, I appreciate that you kind of voice that we both stand in a radically pluralistic place that's not trying to make one thing better than another. And from and you know, freeing up the not so interesting conversation about, you know, who's realization is better, you know, kind of my awakening, you know,
destructive,
yeah,
leading to wars around the world. Yeah,
exactly.
Let's not do that one.
Exactly. Kind of asserting and very, very clearly, you know, choosing not to go into that disposition. Still, one of the most interesting and rich things to investigate is, well, what is it that is conferred by this particular approach that is valuable, and what is it that's conferred by that? And what I'm hearing in your description there is that perhaps the rigor of discipline, of attention, and the release into free awareness that is conferred by a practice of both mindfulness and concentration in the Theravadin path, which is the school that you have practiced in, done most of your meditating in, arrives you at a quality of ground that it's compatible with a rational agnosticism. It seems to presume almost nothing, and therefore it rests with greater ease. It seems more thoroughly unthreatenable because it rests on no hypotheses at all, or is minimal. You know, it is simply the revelation of the nature of things, and therefore a kind of depth of peace or confidence in the freedom or clarity that it confers may be especially radical, and therefore that is its special virtue.
I think you said that better than I could have. I think that's exactly right. There's a peacefulness and a release that comes from, for me, again, just in my practice, and from the release of this experience being anything significant, anything that is revealing the purpose of the cosmos or the unfolding of consciousness or anything at all, other than just the consequences of, does it lead to more wisdom and compassion, and I would add joy. To the individual life. You know, from the flip side, though, right, there are a lot of Mahayanists and Vajrayanists who think like that the Theravadin tradition, it's like blind, right? I mean, you're doing all this work and you're surrounded by luminous awareness and not picking your head up to look around and suddenly say, wow, I'm surrounded by luminous awareness, and this consciousness seeing out of my eyes is not mine, but is universal consciousness. And, you know, and there is that, I really do see that. I know, you know, my friend Kenneth Folk was on the show recently, and, you know, has his model of the different gears of contemplative practice. And, you know, just staying with the auditing of one's own experience, like, keeps you in I forget the exact gears, like, it keeps you in first gear. You never move to see the, you know, to really ask, who am I, and to suddenly decide, suddenly find that it's not just nothing with the lowercase n, but actually nothing with the big uppercase n. So I see both sides of that. I think for me, again, it does kind of come down to which style feels the most, you know, works the most with one's personality, and which part you want to emphasize the most in one's own practice, and what ingredients are the right recipe for the particular hunger. And I really resonate, I think, with something you said earlier, that, you know, we come to practice generally because of dukkha, because of suffering, and whatever that suffering is. And you know, ultimately, the Buddha said, right, Gautama Buddha said that I don't really teach anything other than suffering and the end of suffering. And so, to me, that is as contentful as a yardstick as I would ever want to have. That if there's a different skillful means that leads to liberation and release of suffering and more presence, then by all means, you know, it's not, I don't think it's prescriptive, but I think you're right. There's a truthfulness to the subtractive Dharma that for me has been a resting place and a refuge.
Well, I think that the celebration of that is entirely, I don't know, I don't think that. I feel it as a gift that I am appreciating. And yet I think I feel like I can dialogue with you in a richer way because you've also confessed, you know, in the beginning of this dialogue, in everything is God, in an appreciation for the panentheist view, in an appreciation for the luminosity of emptiness and all the rest. And everything in this conversation has not been an argument of one pole against the other, but different ways of standing in an inclusivity. It is the fact that you have stood with, you know, the kind of tears of amazed gratitude in contemplation of, you know, the exalted holiness of existence. Also, you know, it's not only the subtractive that I feel like I am speaking with a fellow, you know, with a brother, and that leads me to appreciate something that you said in one of our earlier conversations about how, you know, what happens when your experience evolves across the course of your life of practice, and would it be a richer mystical journey if it, instead of having one particular flavor as its flavor throughout its expression, it was so unattached that it moved from one to another of these poles of this enduring polarity and perhaps of other enduring polarities, such that grounded in a radically non-dual panentheist agnostic, and, you know, so agnostic that it's free even to temporarily believe, you know, that in the course of one's life, then one finds brotherhood with all sincere practitioners in any moment of their journey, and perhaps the universality of the kind of mystical, you know, world spirituality, world mystical awakening that may be in the process of evolving, draws its universality from a non-exclusive, you know, non-rigid, certainly, and certainly not also non-exclusive journey through all these different lokas, through all these different places, appreciating that appreciating that any fixity calcifies, and that flexibility and aliveness are the nature of the Tao.
And I think that's I think that's our contribution as Westerners as well. I'm certainly not one of those Orthodox believers in any of the traditions that I've practiced who, you know, has the view that this tradition is perfect as it is. I think what's interesting about evolving Dharma is that it's evolving, and I think precisely the pluralistic, many-faced, integral approach that you've just described is one of the ways in which the Western Dharma is building on the traditions that it has received. And obviously, you know, we both know there are all kinds of pitfalls in that, right? You don't want to just be a dilettante on the spiritual salad bar and do a little of this and a little of that, and it kind of just mushes together and you don't get any real depth. But I think there's, you know, for myself, with the practices that I've spent a lot of time on, whether it's the Theravadan Buddhist path or the Kabbalistic and Hasidic mystical Jewish path, or for that matter, you know, even some that I've spent less time on, but still done a little bit of work in shamanic traditions in South America and in kind of North American earth-based spirituality. It is that deep knowing and understanding that's actually enabled me to do some of the more out there political work that I've done. You know, before Evolving Dharma, my last book was, as you mentioned, this book called God versus Gay with a question mark. And I was dialoguing with hardcore right-wing evangelical Christians who were positive that I was going to hell. And it wasn't just kind of about empathy and skillful dialogue. It really was trying to inhabit that worldview, which is a particular spiritual worldview, and trying to get it and see what's at stake and get a little taste of what the juice and the juiciness of that perspective was like to really get it. You know, I think a lot of the dialogue in the political space around religion is, you know, between so-called defenders of religion and so-called defenders of secularism. And that leaves out all of us who are in a place that's neither one nor the other, I think. And it leaves out the possibility of really inhabiting one another's worldviews in a way that is fully respectful, but also really embodied. So for me, the it may seem very distant, the kind of doing political activism around religion and sexuality, and on the other hand, appreciating holding both the emptiness and the fullness in one's own contemplative practice. Those two things may seem somewhat distant, but for me, they're actually ones they've really fed one another.
Yeah, I can see how that is. Now, my original teacher, Adi Da, did his sadhana in the Kashmir Shaivite tradition, which is epitomizes a panentheism. It's both non-dual and, you know, theistic. It's about straddling those paradoxes. So it's a kind of an epitome panentheist tradition. And, of course, he really kind of transcends and draws to an even kind of higher clarity. What I find myself wondering, because he would express this as, you know, in fact, one of his books was titled The Enlightenment of the Whole Body. And by the whole body, you know, he's referring there to the enlightenment of the mind, the enlightenment of the feeling being, the enlightenment of the embodied being, the, you know, kind of all our different faculties, all our different dimensions. And, you know, in our book, you quote a conversation that you had with Kenneth Falk, who was my last guest, as you pointed out, in pointing out that the different contemplative fitness practices, as he likes to call them, and you like to use that phrase too, build different inner muscles. And it would seem to me then that if different practices emphasize different muscles and there is potentially an enlightenment of the whole body being, is there both a strength and a weakness to each specific practice? Like, for instance, does the Theravadan Buddhist practice regimen, the palette of practices, particularly Vipassana and Shamatha, mindfulness and concentration and jhana practice, does that kind of epitomize, like drill a very deep hole in terms of attentional discipline and the freedom from the automaticities of attention and feeling and kind of freeing you in a radical way? But does it also, in building that kind of mental stability and non-reactivity and clarity, does it emphasize that and not an emotional flexibility and fullness and feeling life and incarnation and therefore social aliveness and flexibility and affiliative connectedness? And is it therefore not only uniquely strong in a certain respect, but also therefore incomplete in another respect, which we would say about any particular practice, not to make it uniquely deficient here, but to say that every practice would therefore have that strength and weakness. And therefore, to what degree can we even account for this? Because as a practitioner of particularly the two traditions that you have depth in, the Jewish and the Theravadin, is your perspective, you know, enlarged by the fact that there are two that you've gone deep into, but still shaped by them and therefore limited by them, such that even trying to account for what lies beyond your experience, you know, you're handicapped, as am I, you know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for me, I did experience a certain emotional resiliency and openness in the you know, when I was doing 5 months of Theravadin retreat, but I definitely did not experience enlightenment of the body. It's not a body loving tradition in its original Asian monastic form, which is I was practicing in Nepal, and you know, I had to kind of remind myself, like look in the mirror, and you know, I'd lost all this weight because there's not much eating, and I wasn't paying any attention, obviously, to kind of my physical you know, appearance, and just remind myself who I used to be and who I would be again. You know, that this was a practice for that I had taken on for a particular period of time, and that it wasn't how I was going to live the rest of my life, you know, not having sex and not eating after noon and all those, the kind of monastic, quasi-monastic precepts that that one takes in that context. So, and it was definitely, you know, I made a choice to renounce those practices for a period of time for a particular purpose, and knowing full well that I would come back to my you know, my householder life and my sex life and my food life also, for that matter. And I agree. I think that, you know, it depends what you want, you know, and where you're, which muscles you want to build. I think what I like about the contemplative fitness language is that it's something that, you know, physical fitness is something really familiar to us. And, you know, do you want to build muscle mass, or do you want to build flexibility, or do you want to do cardio? And I think most folks in the privileged American West, we want to do some of each and have it be balanced. And that can be the case in our contemplative practice as well. Again, being careful not to, you know, if you only do one rep of every machine in the gym, you're not going to actually build anything. There does need to be some degree of focus to do the work. But there's, you know, one piece I wanted to add was this irony that this very dour monastic form of Buddhism is now, via healthcare and other applications of mindfulness, kind of the most widespread form of contemplative practice in America, which is really weird, if you think about it, that it's particularly derived from, you know, that particular corner of the Dharma universe that is the least was the least interested in householder life. But again, you know, thanks to some very skillful teachers, both Asian and American, it's been transmuted into something which, you know, you can do mindfulness-based stress reduction and not have any notion that you're involved in some part of the evolving Dharma, that the Dharma has evolved beyond itself. And I think there's something to that partialness, not partiality in the sense of bias, but that it is a partial practice that's enabled the malleability of this part of the Dharma, you know, such that it can even be taught in context that you or I might find really objectionable, you know, teaching Goldman Sachs bankers how to be more ruthless, you know, and teaching soldiers how to be more calm while they inflict harm on other beings. It's so malleable that it can even be misused.
Yeah. That, I feel impulses to take that in three or four different directions, but I'm going to focus on the one that I had already decided was important. You know, in the conversations we had earlier leading up to this, you had once said to me that, you know, your sense that the hope of the world is stuff like the yoga craze and the mindfulness craze and the permeation of mainstream culture by some basic level of practice, even if it's relatively lowest common denominator and not as profound, and those practices might just lead to a certain equanimity and clarity and freedom and a little bit less attachment, a little more capacity to see the perspectives of others and to be oriented toward Dharma but not necessarily deeply awake. And that those might really be the front lines of what would change the world, and that And I would add to that, that you said that, and I would say that I see a dramatic acceptance of particularly Theravadin practice by scientists who can measure and verify the benefits of it, the kind of work that my friend Rick Hansen has done in identifying, you know, Buddha's brain and the hardwiring happiness in his recent books, and this confluence of science and contemplative fitness, neurodharma, and even psychotherapy really has a lot of promise of kind of succeeding and actually, you know, infecting mainstream, you know, what was humanism may begin to have its own kind of agnostic spirituality, and it would be of this ilk, you know, touched by Theravadin meditation and by yoga practice mainly, and that may be what really is the hope of rapid social transformation more than anything else. And in some ways, we may be, you know, that really may be where the action is in terms of evolving Dharma. So I want to give you a chance to really speak to that, because it's, to me, it does seem like an aspect of what is really happening. And I'd like to give you a chance to kind of celebrate and elaborate on that.
Yeah, you've stated my view once again better than I could. I think it is the case, I think, that the vulgar spiritual practices will save the world. And by vulgar, I simply mean, you know, kind of adulterated, watered down, diluted spiritual practice. And I say that from having, you know, many years just teaching, you know, and anytime you have a group of students, you know, some will get it and some won't and some will really get it. And I think that's true for meditation and mindfulness and in the evolving Dharma, that there will be a lot of folks who encounter mindfulness in the healthcare context, but then take the next step and then maybe actually look at the practices of virtue that are meant to surround mindfulness, right? So non-harming and truthfulness and things like that. And I think that some percentage of those folks will even take the next step and you know, maybe do a longer retreat and make contemplative practice kind of a big piece of their lives. And I think what's important is, you know, as I set out on my own work, kind of straddling contemplative practice and the academy and activism, there's always been a push-pull for me of wanting to reach what activists call the movable middle. You know, the folks who might vote one way or the other, or might go one way or the other on an issue. And I think secularized mindfulness is doing that. And we are really at a point of inflection in terms of the adoption of mindfulness as the sort of econometric data becomes better known, exactly how much mindfulness interventions decrease healthcare utilization or improve productivity or the well-being of employees. You know, in large corporations, if you got a 1% increase in employee happiness and well-being, that's an enormous financial benefit because it, you know, translates into retention and into productivity and sustainability of the business. And so, you know, even small interventions will have very significant financial impact. I think we ain't seen nothing yet, in short. For better and for worse. I think all of us who have been doing practice for a while, you know, you see the kind of mindfulness TM, not like transcendental meditation, TM, like trademark, you know, trademark mindfulness programs, and kind of it has an air of hucksterism around it sometimes, and I think we're right to be suspicious. At the same time, if this can be the gateway drug to serious contemplative practice, for millions of Americans, and right now the data is literally that 1 million Americans are trying meditation for the first time each year. I mean, that's a huge number of folks who are, and unprecedented in the history of the world, folks who are coming into contact with a contemplative practice that has such positive potential and also some, you know, real potential for negative impact as well. But the fact that this liberating technology of mind has evolved into something so secularized that the Marines can teach it and prisons can teach it and schools can teach it, I think it does give me a degree of hope, because I've seen in my own life and in the lives of many folks that it can, over time, lead to a little bit more gentleness, a little bit more compassion, And I've sure got a long way to go, but I've seen those impacts in my own life, and that does give me a degree of hope.
Yeah. Well, you know, I join you in that, and I really do think that in terms of my presenting question for this series, you know, how can higher consciousness help human beings rise to meet the challenges of our time? This penetration of actual practice into a bigger and bigger slice of the population, into it still might not be at the center of mainstream, but becoming more and more mainstream is key. And things like Google Search Inside Yourself, Wisdom 2.0, even people taking up, Kenneth Folk was criticizing this in our last interview, you know, that meditation is not just if you really awaken, you don't just become better able to cope with a meaningless job. You might end up having the freedom to choose not to have a meaningless job and to make different choices altogether. It shouldn't make you a better cog in a machine that lacks a moral rudder. It should actually enable you to notice the lack of that moral rudder and to supply it for yourself. Nonetheless, we have a lot of different bases for criticizing the way in which all this is mainstreaming. It still it will both help people function better under the conditions of stress and help, even as it reduces our stress and our dysfunction and our unhappiness, it may also create a capacity for conscience and a choiceful relationship to the patterns of our lives that can create a different kind of resilience and resourcefulness and intelligence, whereby we can actually become the source of a different kind of responsibility that can steer our whole society in a direction of a more sustainable relationship to our each other and our planet. So I'm hopeful about it, even though it often doesn't interest me. I find myself feeling like, yeah, but then don't we need to have exemplars of deeper practice and deeper realization, and even not just depth of a traditional realization, but the flexibility of a Dharma that's alive and evolving, such that, you know, it's almost like a hydraulic system. We're not going to draw people into the broad end of the funnel unless there's some suction at the narrow end. And don't we need to keep this more refined level of discussion, like embodied here in this discussion we're having right now, very alive and very vibrant in order to kind of, isn't that just as key to the evolution of Dharma as this broad proliferation of vulgar practice?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if God help us, if we were just left with only the vulgarizers, that would be a disaster. And I think again, it is kind of some percentage of folks will want to take this further, and when they're ready for us, we'll be here. I like you. I am delighted to see mindfulness being taught everywhere, and I have no desire to do it in terms of my own. You know, actually going out and trying to reach a movable middle audience. You know, and just reminding myself, well, it's hard to be a mindful Republican, so just teach people to be mindful, and then it'll be harder to be a Republican, which is the goal, right? God bless those people who are doing that frontline work. And that's true, you know, I've seen that in many levels of my own political activism as well. You know, I chose to do that for a little while, but it's tiring to kind of be on that sort of a front line. But no, absolutely, there's so much that we don't even know, even just on the basics of practice. And so to have folks who are representing, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years of teaching and experience, I think is really crucial. And you know, it's ironic that meditation is now seen as a way to relax, when actually when you go on a meditation retreat, it can be highly unrelaxing because you see all of your stuff and it's not pretty, and you know, then if you get into the deeper stages of practice, you know, things start breaking apart and there's no more mountain and you thought there was a mountain, and you know, that can be terrifying. And there's whole in the book as well, I go through the Theravadin map of, you know, the dark night of the soul, so to speak, that one goes through in serious contemplative practice. It's anything but relaxing. And yet, so I sometimes wonder if we're being disingenuous allowing people to sell this as a relaxation tool, but I don't think we are, because the, on a moment-to-moment basis and in daily life practice where you're not getting into those kinds of depths, this is still a very useful technology. And one, you know, I tried in the book too to, it gives some readers whiplash that, you know, one moment we're talking about search inside yourself at Google, and the next moment I'm talking about extended jhana practice, you know, on a retreat with a Burmese meditation teacher. But the hope was to portray some of the breadth of how practice evolves and the different ways in which the Dharma is evolving now. And we absolutely need each other. And if there's not a, if there isn't an avant-garde going out there and continuing to really deepen and to really explore, then the rest of us are just without a compass.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful. Well, I want to keep going forward. There are actually some really important points that I had intended to touch on in our original first hour of dialogue, but we are a little after the 11 o'clock Pacific hour, and so it's time for me to offer a couple of announcements. But first, if you have any questions for Jay or me, if you're listening by phone, please raise your hand by pressing star 2 on your telephone keypad, or if you're listening online on your computer, just type your question into the instant teleseminar window now. And I'd like to make sure you know how to find out more about Jay's work. He is the author of the new book that we've been really riffing on. A lot of this discussion, you can get into a rich exploration of certain of the topics that we have been discussing by reading Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment, which is being released on the 15th in just a little over a week by North Atlantic Books. One reviewer wrote, "This is not only the best book on contemporary mindfulness, it is the first of its kind." His book combines personal narrative, that it's, he, you know, he really shows up in it and lets himself, it's self-disclosing in the best sense in that it, he helps himself be a bridge to the living matter we're talking about here. But it also embodies significant scholarship on the evolution of meditation in the West. And he's traveling across the country to promote it, so you can find event listings with him and booking information online at jmichelson.net and at jmichelson.net, jaymichelson.net. You can also see his recent blog posts. He blogs pretty actively. You can get on his mailing list. You can find out how to follow him on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, et cetera. I also want you to be aware of my work. Even if you are on the mailing list for Beyond Awakening, you're not necessarily on my personal mailing list, which is at terrypatton.com. So I invite you to go there where you can read my blog and find out more about upcoming events with me and about working with me individually and get on my personal mailing list. So let's check in here. There are a couple of people who've raised their hands here with questions. Let's go with a live question first. This is a cell phone in Portland, Oregon. You are with us. Please introduce yourself. A 503 area code cell phone. Go ahead. You're unmuted. Did you raise your hand? See if you're muted locally. We're not hearing you.
Ah, technology.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to remute you. We couldn't hear you, but you're welcome to try again. I'm going to take you off here. I'm going to go to Nate Kalman in Omaha, Nebraska, or at least the phone is homed there. You're live with us now. Hi, Nate.
Nate has passed away. This is his wife, Mary Kalman, calling.
Oh.
And I had a question or on a, you one of you, I think maybe it was Jay, who mentioned in the beginning of the presentation when he was talking about panentheism and in his book, Everything is God and Everything is Consciousness, and he talked about luminous emptiness in Tibetan Buddhism. Then he mentioned Sharon Salzberg saying that everything is born in a blur, and I think I might have misinterpreted that, and I just wondered if you could elucidate that a little bit.
Sure, thanks for that, and I'm sorry if I misspoke, because that's, thanks for the opportunity to clarify. What Sharon had said is not that everything is born in the blur, but that the self, the conventional self, is born in the blur.
Ah.
And so if all of the time where, you know, we're acting and reacting, and it goes by so quickly that we don't notice what's really happening, and we think it's the self that's doing that, but it's the self that's born in the blur.
Uh-huh. Thank you. That clarifies it very, very much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Your name was Shirley, was that right?
Mary.
Mary. Pardon me. Thank you, Mary. Nice
yes.
to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Okay. You know, that question and that answer actually touches on one of the other points that I had hoped to get into during our original hour, Jay, and so I'd kind of like to segue over to that, which is identity and the way that identity is deconstructing in the postmodern era and the way that Dharma's, you know, kind of unraveling of the solidity of identity is interacting with that and your journey through that in terms of your different identities. I'd like to give you an opportunity to speak to that a little bit, because I think that's one of the very rich aspects of your book.
Thanks. Yeah, I think, you know, for me, there's sort of a naive notion that, there are two naive notions that I wanted to get away from in my own practice, and certainly in kind of talking about it in the book, that one is, I am who I am, and this is my identity, and I am this person, and that is who I am. And the other is, the other pole, that all of that somehow melts away, and that all of our specificity, whether it's our gender or our class, our economic class, or our national background, our ethnicity, that somehow good spiritual practice is practice in which there's no more identity and no more difference, and it doesn't matter who you are. And both of those poles, I think, are really incorrect and deeply unhelpful to practice. It's particularly unhelpful for marginalized groups to be told, oh, your identity is not important, and we're just going to dissolve you into the whole, even though the whole is not surprisingly generally made up of the people who have the most privilege, whether it's, you know, the white male club or whomever else. So, you know, that identity remains very important, and that it colors who we are, and it colors how we approach practice and identities of different kinds. But that at the same time, I think we are at, as you alluded to, there's a remarkable moment now in which identities are fragmenting and being taken on in so many different ways that it's really quite liberating. I think one subject I talk about in the book, which we talked about a little bit earlier, kind of the I-spirituality model of contemplative practice. So just as we go on, we used to get records, and they were of music that were ordered by somebody else. You know, the tracks were put in order, and they were all one artist or one genre. And now, you know, we mix and match on whether it's an iPod playlist or a Spotify list or what have you. That we're doing the same thing with spiritual practice, for better and for worse. And we're doing the same thing with identity. We're taking pieces from different parts and figuring out how they work pragmatically. And I think to just kind of own that that form of multiple identity and multiple identity construction is not only helpful to one's own practice, but is a deep and profound teaching in and of itself, that these forms of identity are shifting and that there is not actually a stable identity that's underneath all of those. And I've seen that particularly in the LGBT space, which, you know, the acronym lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender is itself meant to be part of the point, that we don't all, none of us, of whatever sexual or gender identity, can be reduced to the labels that are often put on us. And so for me, that practice of embracing difference while at the same time refusing to be captured by identity, especially an identity that someone else has constructed, been an important piece, not just of how the Dharma gets adapted into daily life, but how daily life gets it brought into the Dharma. We don't want to just bring practice into our lives, after all. We also want to bring our lives into practice. I stole that from the Buddhist Geeks community, but I think they're right.
Yeah. Now, you said a couple of things there that are, to me, very important provocative points, and I'm going to elbow myself in front of listener question in order to go into that a little bit more deeply, because I think it's so important. This mix and match playlists of identities and playlists of spiritual practices, you pointed out, you know, for better and for worse. And as I feel into it, I can see the for better kind of expressed in what I articulated myself a little earlier in our conversation, that this flexibility allows us in a lifetime to roam around a great deal, and we are you know, it breaks up fixity. It creates a kind of potential for flexibility, for exploration, for a much more alive, less calcified identity, and for a much more alive, less calcified practice. But on the negative side, it seems to me that the traditional teachings about what a wily and insidious process ego is, and how it converts everything to its own purposes, and we become materialistic about our spirituality, and that there are deep shadow motives toward avoidance that are going to operate outside our awareness. So even with the greatest sincerity and discernment apparently being brought, we are going to tend to replicate our patterns unconsciously, and the ways that we're going to mix and match among practices and even identities perhaps is likely to help us preserve the places of withholding that, you know, it has been traditionally the submission to a will outside one's own. And that submission to a teacher, however much the potential for the abuse of power will arise in that traditional mode, it was really good at breaking beyond the preferences of the ego pattern of the individual. And the contemporary culture, particularly postmodern meaning-making, is often critiqued as being profoundly narcissistic. And doesn't that narcissism cease to be disciplined by practice in this context? And is Dharma losing its grounding in a kind of hierarchy of authority that's necessary to bust people beyond their own ego pattern? It seems to me that there's some truth in that critique, and that very often now Dharma offerings are like commercial offerings, and the customer is king, and the customer is Narcissus, the ego, and doesn't want what really dethrones it, and therefore there's a tendency for people to be shoppers at the spiritual cafeteria and not really be changed by their practices. How are you mixing and matching that truth along with everything else that's in the mix for you?
Yeah, I think I agree completely that is the that is the shadow side of high spirituality and of mix and match. In general, my gut feeling, my gut feeling that I've been looking at for 15 years is that for me, at least, the benefits are outweigh the cost. I think, I'm just not a guru kind of guy, and I recognize the value of a guru-like teacher for precisely the reasons that you said. Otherwise, if you're in control, if the small self is in control, it's going to pick and choose exactly what leaves the small self intact, and that's kind of not the point, right? So I'm on board with that critique, and yet, I really am actually encouraged, particularly by kind of the rising millennial generation and how they relate to power and authority generally. I think we have to go through a kind of anti-authority period before maybe we'll be able to reinvent what authority could really look like. And, I think just some of the scandals that have come out of the Dharma community in terms of the abuse of power and sex in particular, it's no coincidence that the highest concentration of those scandals come from the forms of teaching that have the most kind of hierarchy and power relationships between teacher and student. And so I think there's, there's in the, I'll get really super traditional now, you know, the traditional three Buddhist refuges are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right? The Buddha is the teacher, but it's the Buddha as the historical figure, the Buddha in your teacher, and also the Buddha in yourself, right? And then there's this, then there's the refuge of the Dharma, which is the teaching itself. And I think there is value in considering a submission to the Buddha and the Dharma in that context, but that's not the same as submission to a teacher necessarily. And then, of course, there's the Sangha. And when I look at kind of some of the emerging Dharma communities online and elsewhere that are really taking place, that are very iconoclastic and that have a deep suspicion of authority, I think it is possible to submit to the teaching without submitting to a particular teacher in the way that that's been generally understood. And again, I none of what I've just said contradicts or even undermines what you've said about the dangers that are inherent there. I think those dangers are there. But as for myself, I think that I'd rather have a world with those dangers and with the benefits of an occupied Dharma that comes from practitioners rather than from a hierarchy. I'd rather have both of those than neither.
Well, that's a rich thing that we could mine much more deeply if we had more time, but I'm going to turn to some questions we have from listeners. Shirley in Folsom asks, from your perspective, Jay, what are the strengths and weaknesses of Ken Wilber's integral theory and Aqual approach?
Interesting. I think, for myself, the integral approach played a really important part in my own coming to understand these different traditions and how they related to the different parts of myself and what a well-rounded person would look like. You mentioned earlier, Terry, the enlightenment of the whole body with the different aspects of the body, mind, heart system. And I think that approach has been really helpful for me there as well. Where I've found it less nourishing has been on the Sangha side, as someone who's kind of danced around the integral community for a while. I've just not found the community meeting the needs that I have of a community, which isn't to judge the community, it's just to talk about where the match is for myself. And I think it's any time that there's a danger, I think, of sectarianism, any time a community kind of constitutes itself around certain teachings, and then what's the orthodoxy of the sect and what's not, and who's in and who's out, and what teachers should be allowed to get this platform and what teachers shouldn't, and I've had disagreements with the community on that subject in particular. I'd love to see the academic side of me would love to see more integration of the integral approach within the sort of academic and scholarly literature. One of my previous careers, as a law professor, which we haven't talked too much about, thankfully, in that career I wrote the first application of the integral approach to issues of law and religion. And I think that the developmental approach to consciousness, as Wilber kind of sets out on the public space, is something that's sorely lacking in most in certain aspects of scholarship that tend to have a very reductive and not awakened sense about what religion might be or what liberalism might be or any of the points along the matrix that we might want to look at but then question and then situate and then reanalyze. And I think there's a real space there, and that I hope will begin to be filled in the next few years.
Great, thank you. It's interesting to hear that, having been so associated with Ken and the integral world. It's interesting to hear those reflections. Ari in Tucson asks a very interesting question. Because consciousness moves in each person differently. How can a Dharma or meditation teacher hold the space and guide students for the whole spectrum of experience that might arise, from mindfulness, concentration, relaxation, to the dark night of the soul?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think, I'll, again, just speak from my experience, one of the appealing aspects of the particular path that I chose to pursue in some depth was, as I said earlier, that there was a roadmap. And, you know, the map is not territory. And there, you can't just sort of assume that the things will unfold in the same way. Nonetheless, it was remarkable in the development of my own practice how, not 100%, but, you know, how useful those maps ended up being. That was actually really striking to me, particularly because I, you know, my vanity is seeing myself as some sort of unique creature that, you know, there's just not that many, you know, queer Buju neo-Kabbalists out there. and yet, for all of that supposed uniqueness, the maps were really helpful for me. And I think that, you know, to answer the question even more directly, the right teacher is someone who can address all of those aspects of the student and see exactly what's similar and what's different among different people. You know, for me, I think just tying the different questions together, my own suspicion of gurus and teachers and my own choices not to put that much into a single teacher are related. There was a while, you know, about 10 years or so that I thought, okay, I need to find the teacher, the person who gets all of me and who can hold all of the different parts of me and my practice and so on. And I did give that up. It just didn't seem as if it was going to happen, and I stopped wanting it to happen. So when I've submitted to teachers many times, whether it's my shaman in Peru or my teacher in Nepal or what have you, it's been more limited in duration than that and more limited in scope. And it's been a little bit more of clearly I'm here to learn something and here's what I'm here to learn. And I'm not going to set up roadblocks of this person needs to get this piece. This person needs to not be a homophobe in order for me to learn from him. I mean, if I had that screen, I wouldn't have half the teachers that I have. Or this person needs to have a spiritual practice that I can really respect and relate to in order for me to learn from them, you know, the tools of activism and political engagement. Well, there again. So I've tended to invest somewhat less in single teachers than what I hear kind of in the background of the questions.
And it sounds like you're framing that as a description of what has worked best for you and may work for others, but which it may be that for some people a deeper and more abiding relationship to a single teacher might have, you know, confer benefits that would be more prominent for that unique individual, and then there would be different dangers they would have to navigate, and they wouldn't get some of the benefits of moving around as you have, but you're not putting that forward as the superior way to navigate the path necessarily.
Yeah, no, of course not. I think if a traditional guru-disciple relationship works, I've known so many people whose lives have been transformed by being in that relationship. Part of me is a little bit jealous of them, but certainly I think it's not one size fits all.
Yeah. Okay. Good. There are two questions that kind of relate that I'd like to give you at once. Ellie in Santa Rosa asked about reaching people in tribal cultures, where Moon in San Francisco says, you mentioned shamanism and earth-based practices as being a part of your path. How do you reconcile the belief in compassionate spirits in shamanism with a non-dual and, you know, particularly Buddhist Theravadan views?
Sure. I mean, I think like a lot of particularly Westerners who encounter indigenous traditions, I think for me there's an internal translation process that happens to a sort of Western quasi-psychoanalytical or psychological frame, such that, you know, if I'm agnostic about non-duality, I'm certainly agnostic as to exactly what's going on in some of these shamanic experiences that I've had. They're incredibly powerful and they seem very real, and I definitely have no idea. You know, it's easy for a Westerner to sort of say, well, look, whether these are spirits out there, entities out there, or whether these are in the mind, or, you know, what does it even mean for spirits to be out there if there's no self? You know, where all of us are tendencies of our own and other minds. That's sort of how I tend to approach the more mythic aspects. You know, and that's true not just in indigenous traditions, but it's true within Buddhist traditions as well. Whether it's making an offering to Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara, or, you know, some of the other devotional practices that exist within Buddhism, there's many ways to see those. You know, for me, the notion that there's a beneficent being filled with compassion who's helping me out, you know, I've gone through some tough times in life and over the years, and sometimes those can be really helpful, but other times less so. So I think it's again sort of a skillful means question. But right within you don't have to go farther. Right within the Buddhist tradition itself, we have those pieces that are there, and obviously within various Hindu traditions as well.
You know, I feel moved to chime in just a little bit to say that the way I hold that paradox is that a big part of who I am and how I navigate is rational, and it's informed by kind of rigorous philosophical examination out of which there is a way to account for a domain of subtle energy like Wilbur's aqua model points to, in which there can be structures built up in subtle domains where all these people praying to Jesus in the mode of Catholicism, or the experience and cartographies of the inner worlds that are worked out by different shamanic traditions, have a kind of reality and can be contacted and can be used more or less skillfully, and therefore there's a basis for it, and maybe at times there are non-ordinary capacities that can be liberated through working those dimensions of subtle energy, and people can go into zones of capacity with extraordinary abilities, and all kinds of things can get, you know, like I can make room for miracles and make room for non-ordinary experience with that explanatory matrix. And out of that, then I can honor somebody who's developed a deep relationship with a source of grace that seems to operate for their benefit. But I think that it's a slippery slope, and that I can find myself all kinds of bound in by all kinds of metaphysical and spiritual beliefs that make my world smaller and don't grant me the freedom that this clarified, rational, and kind of panentheist/agnostic kind of free view that we've both rooted ourselves in confers. So I tend to frame my openness to those kind of compassionate spirits, you know, inside this relatively spacious and unadorned kind of philosophical frame.
Yeah, and I think one of my friends is a teacher, Eliezer Sobel, said, "I don't know what the meaning of life is, but it's definitely not to have a bad time." And I think, you know, I think you're right. I mean, when the auditing of metaphysics and the hyper-rationalism becomes just sort of a dour skepticism, you know, I think there's a sign that we're having a bad time. And it's also true that, you know, when you visit a power place of whatever tradition, it's sure hard to, I mean, maybe that's all in your mind when you feel whatever that energy is that's there, but it sure doesn't seem that way. You know, it sure seems that, you know, you go to, I remember Bodhnath, the stupa right to the east of Kathmandu. I think it's in one of the films, like Baraka or one of those. You know, you go there and there's this intense energy in the place, or the Western Wall in Jerusalem, or countless other sacred places where I've been. And you got to be a pretty dour kind of guy to really say, no, there's nothing going on here. So I think we need to get the juice back into agnosticism, which is meant to be openness to the many levels of possible experience.
Nice. You know, Jay, I have really enjoyed this conversation with you. I feel like we've ranged over a lot of territory in a very free and interesting way, and you've shown your flashlight on a lot of particulars that are, I think, illuminating and valuable. You may want to reflect on the conversation and what about it you think is most important. It may be that there are aspects of what you had meant to communicate about evolving Dharma in this dialogue that you didn't get a chance to, and I just kind of want to give you a chance to make a final statement that, you know, as long as or short as you like, that kind of can range through whatever reflections you have on what we've, you know, said and whatever else might be important to presence, just to bring it to a place of completeness.
Well, thanks for that opportunity. Yeah, this has been really wonderful for me as well. And it's actually, there were some nice points along the way where I half wanted to start taking notes so that I could jot it down for when I start giving talks about the book, which, you know, I'm going out on tour in a few weeks. So I didn't do that, but I'll just listen to the podcast and take notes. I think we kept sort of hovering around a certain model of pluralism that I think is a really important one, which is neither relativism nor dogmatism. And, you know, some of it is just holding one's own opinions lightly, and some of it is it's historical consciousness. I think one of the things I really wanted to do with evolving Dharma was, academics use the phrase denaturalize the current state of Buddhism in the West, and all that really means denaturalizes, you know, it didn't just show up this way. It was the result of a lot of people and a lot of historical currents. And I think coming to a greater awareness of that is for me part of the path. It's part of seeking truth and is really helpful. And I think it informs the kind of robust pluralism that goes to the heart of some of the deepest questions that we ask. I remember after kind of earlier on, and I was still doing more Kabbalah and Hasidism in my own spiritual practice, I was talking with my friend Rabbi David Ingber, who's kind of an integral rabbi in New York City, and I said how I'd had these incredible experiences of what felt like mystical union at the time, but later I doubted them, and he kind of stopped me and he said, "You doubt your own peak experiences? You know, like what are you doing? Those are the treasures of being alive." And I said that I did, and I actually, you know, doubt has, certainly in the Dharma, has both a positive and a negative element, right? Skeptical doubt, where you're just shutting everything down, is not helpful. But a gentle prodding and asking and inquiring around even one's own peak experiences, as we've talked about today, you know, there's nothing, it is true, to me at least, there's hardly anything that's more valuable than those moments of pure being or moments of deep awareness and insight. And so even that, I think, is subject to a very gentle, compassionate, and compassion-based questioning, and a light questioning that enables lots of different approaches to how we are to live, to kind of coexist, or at least understand one another. And I think for me, that remains a big piece of the growing edge of my own practice. How to see at least three sides of everything.
Beautiful. Jay, thank you so much. That was just a pleasure. I would, I'm tempted to keep going, but we're over time already. So Just a few final reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for the series at beyondawakeningseries.com. If you want to learn more about Jay Michelson, order and read Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment, and go to his website, jaymichelson.net, jaymichelson.net. And you're also invited to go to terrypatton.com, sign up for my newsletter, inquire about working with me personally, find out about my upcoming events and blogs. Thank you, everybody, so much for joining Jay and me today. Goodbye.